This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. George Bill Gare is here, one of America's most beloved poets. Yeah. And here he is.
Hi, Grace.
A beloved poem.
With a beloved poem. I'm going to read a poem about one of my kids. I've told you before, I'm like the world's oldest first-time dad. And I have two little boys. And here's a poem about the older Michael, who's now six. And the poem is called The Scar. My son slipped on the ladder to the pool and smacked his head, blood dripping on his small shoulders, the doctor stitching him whole. 3 years on, after a haircut, the scar still rises. A quarter moon, a woman will ask about as they lie there one night, her fingers Aww. In his hair, her voice in his ear, the secret delight of him, a bit like burnt toast in her nostrils as she takes his strangeness into her. What she won't know is how that frail, delicate skull I held that day in my hands resounded on the hot concrete. It echoed all summer, less like an egg cracking in a bowl or a world breaking than the wild beating of love against my heart. Dear girl who will win him, that part of the boy is mine.
Oh, George, thank you for that. Thank you so much.
Isn't there that feeling that there's a, I mean, you have your four daughters, right? And they all got married and they went off, but there's part of them, I mean, that no one will ever take away.
But that is what the poet is, the scar on his son's forehead.
Yeah.
Who but a poet? We were talking about your children and you said you had an insight last night at the Folger, which we'll discuss later. But the insight apparently was big one.
Here was the insight. It was, you know, I'm in my 60s now. I'm an older guy. And I think like most poets, you go back to a certain mine, a certain source, right? And for me, as with so many writers, that's my childhood and my parents. And it makes perfect sense that when you're writing and you're starting to publish and kind of come into your own and you're in your 30s, you start looking back on your childhood and thinking about childhood memories and who was your father and who is your mother. And you keep, in my case, you keep writing those poems in your 40s, and then there you are in your 50s, you're writing about your parents. And if you don't have kids, that remains your source. And then it starts seeming a little weird that here you are in your 60s still working out these battles. But if you have kids, and I didn't realize this, that displaces the role of your parents and you have this new place where you go as a writer. It's the old cliche, well, your kids will keep you young. Well, as a writer, they do, because you don't keep going back to that ancient, you know.
That was a good insight. I am going to steal it.
And that's copy. It's a copyrighted insight.
You asked me not to steal anything you said.
And you cannot use it.
I know, because I don't have any sons. You are so lucky.
Well, I'm sure you write about your daughters, and then you write about your grandkids. But if the poet who remains childless,
they never turn the corner.
His parents have a huge responsibility to keep providing material.
That is an essay.
So that's my
brilliant
essay.
You know, I want you to do a book of essays because it would be Mark Twain and Seamus Heaney all mixed
that's
up together.
Idea.
Would you?
Okay.
Just
for next year when I'm here.
That, for example, what we were just saying about your children, that's essay number one.
Essay one,
big
okay.
Big insight.
Why you should have. And I had another insight last night, but it was kind of a dark one. And it was this, that somebody asked a question at the panel discussion about, you know, writing about your parents. And how do you feel about your parents seeing what you have written about them? And I said, I felt that it was the parents' duty to die when you start publishing. So you don't have to worry about them seeing it. And some of the parents in the audience said that seemed unreasonable. But come on, I mean, if you care about the artistic career of your son or daughter.
It's the least they can do.
It's the least you can do.
George Bill Gare is here. We will never be the same. I am Grace Cavalieri, no matter how many times he comes. And this is the Library of Congress. Read us a poem, and then I want to go back and hear what happened at the Folger.
Okay, I'll tell you about it. So here we're talking about parents, and here's a poem about my mother. And, you know, you think you're through with everything you have to say about your parents, but you get ambushed. And I mentioned to you before the show that this past term I was on leave, and I am a teacher in a university. I teach English. And one of the things you don't get to do if you teach English is read for pleasure. You know, that goes away from your life. And you can read millions of essays and things you have to teach, but reading for fun. So I started reading for fun again. And the first book I read last term was Anna Karenina, which I had never read. Believe it or not, we've all got that list of embarrassing things you haven't read. And Anna Karenina was one of mine. But I remember my mom, I was raised by a single mom. My dad died when I was pretty young. And my mom worked, she worked like a dog to raise us. And she was a nurse. But she was a great reader. And her escape was to come home and read these great books. And I started reading Anna Karenina, and I realized I remember my mom reading this book when I was a kid. So this poem is about that. And something that occurred to me while I was reading it. Anna Karenina. My mother was long dead before I was old enough to ask her who she was. But I'm reading Anna Karenina, which I recall her burning through late nights after a double shift, after the insertion of suppositories and the emptying of bedpans, after she fried us up some pork chops and opened a can of applesauce and a can of hominy and a can of fruit cocktail. She'd sit down with her cigarettes and red wine and read these big novels that took her away from thinking all day about money and into whatever Emma Bovary or Eleanor Dashwood was dealing with. She disappeared into French winters. She walked down London streets or sat quietly with Anna in her parlor. I look around in the novel for her cigarettes tonight, her glass of wine, anything she might have left behind.
Oh, I have an essay that you can have. And it is that all of those characters that were written by men, Madame Bovary,
right,
by Flaubert and Anna Karenina, all of them had an affair, and then they had to die.
That's right.
Only because they were written by men.
That's right.
The women's novels.
Required punishment.
Yeah. I know. And how did you feel about that novel?
It's
as good as they say, right?
It's really good.
You should read
it. Yeah. No, I felt... Well, I love the novel. It was a marvelous experience to read it. But that feeling I had that, you know, my mom has been here and she's walked down this street in Russia and she sat in this room and she's had these feelings I'm having. And it was this eerie sense that she was in there or had been. And look, there's a glass of wine. There's essay number two.
Stay with me and you will be published in a year.
It's getting so easy.
Eleanor
Dashwood, by the way, I forgot to mention, she's the heroine of Sense and Sensibility. Isn't that a great name? Eleanor Dashwood.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was just
wonderful. Better
than
Elizabeth Bennet.
Yeah, I think so.
So.
Thank you for that essay.
George Bulgaire is here. Everyone loves him. We're no exception. Folger, did they give you a standing ovation last night?
They did. They gave me a standing ovation that went on for 20 minutes.
Or
it
two.
It was astounding.
the occasion. Tell us about the occasion.
Well, for our listeners, if you've never been in the Folger Shakespeare Library, you're really missing something. It's just a couple of blocks from the Library of Congress. And they've got this astounding, obviously, collection of Shakespeare. But I've read in a lot of reading rooms. And you walk into that reading room, which is really the theater, and it seats about 250 people. So it's not huge, but it's so intimate. And it really feels like the Globe.
It does. It's a miniature Globe.
It feels like a miniature Globe. Mm-hmm. And there are people up in the boxes looking down at you. And it's warm and it's cozy and friendly. And you feel like you're part of this tremendous tradition. And it was just one of the most thrilling moments of my life.
And you've been there before, though.
I had never been to the Folger. I've read at the Library of Congress a few times, but the Folger
many times.
Yeah.
You won't stop.
We cannot
live without you, George. Well, give us a poem that you read last night.
Poem that I read last night. Let's see.
Did you read new ones?
I'll read can I read kind of a romantic poem for my wife? Jody?
I think it's okay.
Is that all right?
Yes. Even though it's the Library of Congress.
Even though it's the Library of Congress. This poem is for Jody. And the only thing you need to know about this poem is that occasionally I teach the history of the lyric. And we start with Old English. And something our listeners should know is a marvelous thing. The Old English word for wife is wife. I mean, the word is that old, but it's wyf, W-Y-F, my wyf. So that word has been with us for centuries, and it's changed a little bit, but it's essentially the same. And it's wonderful to think someone that long ago would say, here is my wyf. So here's the poem. It's called Oddly, Darkly Shifting Flux. At noon, I teach my summer school class, during which some significant Middle English poems on the subject of mortality are strenuously appreciated for 1 hour and 50 minutes. After that, I swim about half a mile under a series of cloudy metaphors at the public pool, and then I bike home. Now it's 3 o'clock, and the next scheduled event of the summer is dinner at 6:30. I am in my house, my domestic setting, with my furniture. We exist together in the dining room for a moment. The break front, the table, the buffet, and I. How lucky we are to be here, so stable and serene in the darkly shifting flux of the cosmos. And there in the backyard is my wife, kneeling amid her conflagration of perennials. My wyf, clad in that fossil syllable, yet so vivid and alive under the sun. It is still 3 o'clock, and it seems like maybe the day is stuck. It's bumped into something just below the surface, and there's no way of getting from here to the next scheduled event except to call to her through the open window and put my arms around her when she comes in and taste the sweat on her neck, the inchoate saltiness, and then let one of us, or it could be both of us, lead the slow breathing animal bodies up the stairs to the cool darkness and take off the tethers and harnesses, remove the reins and halters, and just let them gallop off into that green clearance for a while.
The book is called Imperial. You can have that book and read that poem again and again. And every woman is so sad they're not married to a poet.
It's I feel bad for them.
Because we all kneel in the perennials and nobody notices.
The kneeling in the perennials. I know. Well, I notice.
But that was just real. And for you, I knew you when you were a feckless bachelor.
I was quite feckless.
And now domesticity has just been such a halo around your head. It's so beautiful.
It's been good. I mean, having kids has just been so great.
I know. And to see you with them, it's just
such
a joy.
Yeah, you just saw the little boys. And
yeah, tear apart the library.
They're tearing apart the library. Come see the Library of Congress before it's completely destroyed by
George
these kids.
George Bilger, Grace Cavalieri.
Grace, can I say one little thing to you?
How little?
Well, congratulations on being Poet Laureate of Maryland. I mean, that's just the most amazing thing.
The universe was taken.
The universe was taken aback.
And so I took this.
And I follow you on Facebook. There's not 1 minute when you're not busy. So.
And wait till you see yourself today.
Yeah.
You're going to be like 6 pictures on Facebook.
Okay, that's going to be
George
cool.
George Bilger, I'm going to say it again. Let's have another poem.
Another poem. Yeah, let's see.
These are new.
I have new poems. Here's a poem. Let's do another kid poem. And this too is about my son, Michael. It's called The Barn. This is a flower. The flower is in a pot. The flower needs sunlight and soil and water to live. And he's getting a lot of it wrong, my son, and some of it right, sitting on my lap with his illustrated reading book. I look beyond the yellow daisy to the red barn in the distance. Why is the door closed? What's going on in the barn's unknowable darkness? The horses are in there breathing, standing up as they dream. The goats are wondering why the farmer hasn't come to let them into the day. The pigs are wondering this too, but at a higher level, as pigs are very smart. Perhaps the farmer is lying in bed, dead of a heart attack, or he and his wife were surprised by a flare-up of the ancient original fire that blazed into marriage and a farm and a fine boy like this boy on my lap, for whom reading is not coming easily, who makes me proud when he gets it right. But it's when he gets it wrong, when his voice thins and falters before the inscrutable word, that I love him unbearably. Thinking back to long division and the terrible fractions with their unlike denominators, how I burned at my desk in tiny failure. Son, let's go into the dark barn and listen to the horses breathing. Let's hide out there together for as long as we can.
Lucky, lucky Michael.
He's such a good boy.
Harking back to your essays that are coming out soon.
In 1 year.
And the number three would be the whiff, how that word has come down through centuries.
Oh, that is a good idea.
Uh-huh. We only have four more chapters to go.
Yeah, I'm almost there.
Before we hear another poem, you are from Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah.
And you've been teaching at the University of John Carroll University.
Yeah, for about 25 years.
Is that how long?
It's been my longest gig everywhere, anywhere.
And appears that you will stay.
Well, it seems unlikely I'll leave it. Once your kids are in school, as you know, you're not going anywhere.
I mean, you're true.
You're locked in.
Right. But you teach year after year, and I warned you that I was going to ask you if anything happened this year that was different from any other year. Did somebody say something? Hmm. Did you feel something? Did you? Because to go on year after year, something has to happen
to
keep you going.
Things are changing. Well, of course, you know,
Did somebody thrill you? Did somebody say something smart?
Yeah, I have about every 2 or 3 years, you get a student who makes it all worthwhile. I would say it happens about, you know, you were very hard on me for not writing a book a year. And I told you it takes at least 3 years. I mean, some of us are slower than you, but it seems it takes about 3 years. About every 3 years, a student emerges who is just terrific, who thrills you. And that happened this term. I returned this term. It's a young woman, and I'm going to mention her name on the show, named Jessica Marola. And man, oh man, is she ever good. Jessica, I will make you listen to this.
She's going to be so thrilled.
And she turned in a poem early in the term. And I'm just going to, I don't have the poem with me, but I'm going to tell you a moment in the poem that made me almost, truly, I was sitting in a cafe and I came to the line and I stumbled back in my chair. And the poem was a persona poem. I had asked her to imagine writing a poem as her own grandmother. And her grandmother was describing going to a country dance. Her grandmother grew up in Illinois. She went to a country dance and met this young man. She was just a young woman, maybe 18. And a shy, quiet young man. And in the poem, if you can envision this, they step outside. It's a moonlit night. And the line goes, he put his hand, line break, in my hand. He took my hand, line break, in his hand, period. I tell my grandchildren. And then she says, you kids no longer go to dances. But in other words, in the same line, he put his hand in my hand. I tell my grandchildren.
Oh.
So in one line, you leap forward to everything that had to happen between the hands touching and the grandkids.
And how does she know how to do that?
And that's the thing. That comes from the spirit world. You can't teach it. And when you get that kid, all you do is get out of the way.
I'm so glad I asked about that.
Yeah,
now,
Jessica.
Tell us about your radio show.
I'm still doing that radio show called Wordplay, which you can hear online. It's called, it's a Wordplay, wjcu.org. If you can go to the website and the show is archived, podcasts, and you can listen to live to me and my co-host John Donahue every Friday at 6 o'clock, Cleveland time, East Coast time.
But we have it in all time.
You can hear it at any time because of the World Wide Web.
ORG.
Yeah.
WJCU.org. We can get all we want of you.
All you want.
Like if I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I say, I want George.
It's right now. there you push the button and it happens. And it really is. And you know what? That show in part was inspired by my first meeting of you. In the early 2000s, I came here and did a reading and we did this show. I went down into the bowels of the Library of Congress and I thought, This is the best medium for poetry is radio.
Absolutely. Well, I try to keep you kids off the street.
I know.
Anything I can do for you. Anything I can do. Now, another poem at the Library of Congress.
Something I'm thinking about doing, I haven't shown my kids the Vietnam Memorial yet.
You were there.
I have been there, and I've written about it before, but I wrote a poem about it recently. During the Vietnam War, I was of age, but I got a college deferment, so I did not go to Vietnam. But a lot of my friends did. And that's something you think about throughout your life. Like, what if I had gone? What if my friends hadn't gone? How different would my life have been? This poem is about that and what's happening in Vietnam today. And the one thing listeners need to know, I mention a collection of sonnets by Rilke called Sonnets to Orpheus. And what more than anything, those sonnets are about living a life purely, the possibility of living purely in the imagination, a life existing purely in the poetic imagination, in a sense away from the world. So here's the poem. It's called Deferment. My friends came back from Vietnam, and some of them were pretty messed up, and others got carved into a wall. And the ones who were alive wrote about napalm and landmines and carpet bombing, and I wrote poems about my sensitive soul. And the ones who were dead wrote about burning babies and rice paddies full of blood, while I read sonnets to Orpheus. They wrote about 12-year-old whores with hand grenades in their purses. They wrote about My Lai and rolling thunder and a necklace made of human ears, while I composed a villanelle about my father's love of Puccini, which appeared in a fairly good journal. Nowadays, my friends come back from Vietnam, raving about the pad thai and the pho curry. The bún cha over there is amazing, they say to me. You should go.
Wow.
So, yeah, that, how we've come full circle. Now Vietnam becomes a place you go to sample
place.
Amazing food, you know.
But I just thought of your fourth chapter.
Okay.
The predominant in your poem is the what if. Always in every poem, there's always what if under the line.
That's
and
true.
That's your ballast.
Okay.
And so that's a good... You don't want to give that secret away, maybe, but you always do take that, and it's such an interesting roadmap to watch. You do. So let's have another poem and see if you do it again.
Let's see what happens here. Let's see if another poem...
You can blow my theory. I'm okay.
I might blow your theory, but no. Okay. Let's go back to kid poems again. Maybe this will be my last kid poem. It's called Lullaby. I could say to my 3-year-old, one day, you are going to have to file your own tax returns. That's a beautiful opening of a poem, don't you think, Grace?
Grace is depressing.
In tears. One day, you are going to have to file your own tax returns. Instead, I bring him his Milky Baba. I could say to him, one day, you and your wife will spend all morning at the bank negotiating a homeowner's loan in order to put a bathroom on the first floor. Instead, I wipe his bottom. And I could say to him, one day after the wake, you and your brother, now a fairly successful attorney living for some reason in Des Moines, will go to a Mexican restaurant, order a pitcher of margaritas, and have this long conversation in the unreality of my not being there or anywhere. And it will be very serious, the most serious talk you two have ever had. And then somehow it will turn quite hilarious, and you will tell some stories, I'm sorry, I won't be there to hear, which will lead to another pitcher of margaritas. Instead, I turn it to SpongeBob.
I can't stand
But I'm not really going to die, so don't worry. If you talk about this, what if?
I cannot stand that poem, the beauty of that poem, everything we feel. I said to my husband, they can't go on without us.
And you know that feeling?
You'd be surprised.
You know that feeling, a kind of a feeling of outrage you have when you realize your parents had a life before you were born and that it was a fun life and they enjoyed it without you. It's hard to imagine your kids are going to make it without you. But according to your husband, they will. That's
You'd
very
be surprised.
Disturbing.
Okay. You would be surprised. George Bilgare always lights up every light in the room and in the house and in the country.
And I'm up to 5 chapters now with the essay book?
If you read us another poem, I'll give you another chapter.
Oh, you'll give me another chapter. Okay.
And now a final poem.
Okay. My final poem for the day. Well, let's see. You know what? I think I'm going to read a final kid's poem. And it's called Reichstag. And, you know, I mentioned to you that last summer I took my family to Berlin. Every year we go. And in the summer they have this kind of infestation of little bugs or beetles called firebugs. And this poem has to do with that. Reichstag. My little boy and I are standing in front of the Reichstag, which is burning and coalescing with rich and complicated history right there in front of us. But he doesn't particularly care. In fact, he's not even looking at the darn thing, having focused all his attention instead on a tiny, intricately tattooed black and red beetle at his feet. A firebug, he says. And I know he's right because we looked it up online last week. You see them all the time here in Berlin, or at least he does. And there's really nothing more exciting for him, at least at the moment, than to see a firebug moving through the grass. And I know that the firebug era will soon come to an end, to be replaced by the getting stoned and drunk and calling me from jail era, to be followed by the buying his first condom era, which in time will lead to the moving into his own place era, which I fear, because my own ice age is not that far off, and I will not roam the earth much longer, huge and carnivorous and terrifying, frightening smaller creatures with my roar, lowering my great bulk to kneel alongside a small boy to watch the firebug, inscribed with its ancient and inscrutable hieroglyphics, crawl past us in front of some old building.
George Bilgare, it's enough to break your heart. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.